Today is Wednesday. It's June 1st, 2022. It's 2:35 in the afternoon and high. This is John Williams. Thanks again for listening to, for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can hear portions of this broadcast on WGN Radio on Saturday nights at 8. You can hear my full radio show weekdays on WGN from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Burt from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Schroen of WTTW News.
Brandon Pope of WCIU is on the block with Block Club Chicago.
I'm Eric Zorn, the highly informed publisher of the Picayune Sentinel newsletter.
Is that a slight to your own inability to stay interested in and follow the Amber Heard Johnny Depp story?
A little bit, yeah. I felt guilty. Now, I watched a little bit of it, and every time I tuned in, I thought, well, these are just two people who were in an extremely toxic relationship, and I couldn't sort it out. I saw a lot of the abuse being heaped on Amber Heard online, which made me sympathize with her, and I guess we now know that she's been hit with the worst damage suit. So maybe she was the bad person. But like I said, I didn't follow it closely enough to feel other than just sort of disgusted at myself for watching the few minutes that I did.
There are legitimate lingering, you know, reasons to pay attention to this. First Amendment issues and stuff like that.
I will say there is a eerily similar piece of comedic art called The Trial of Tim Heidecker, and Adult Swim produced it. It's 5 hours long, and it was a mock courtroom drama, basically a storyline of a fake character who accidentally poisoned a lot of kids with vape cartridges at a music festival that he put on. And the way it was shot, the tone, the goofy celebrity nature of it was so eerily familiar because of that piece of art. And that was literally my only thought on it.
Wow. Didn't anticipate that. What's the name of that again?
It's called The Trial of Tim Heidecker.
By the way, we're completely on a tangent now, but I watched the George Carlin two-part HBO documentary last night. Both parts. Really interesting. Really kind of fun. The Pride Parade organizers in Aurora, that's Illinois' second largest city, we've been reminded, are not allowing Aurora police to march in uniform. They can march in soft outfits and maybe khaki pants and the T-shirts that would display the Aurora police insignia, but they can't have their uniforms and guns. Aurora Pride says their LGBTQ members have been harassed by police, if not necessarily the Aurora police. Uniform police presence, they say, could create anxiety, tension, and animosity. Police still have to police the event, but they cannot march in it in uniform. The mayor, gubernatorial candidate Richard Ervin, says he's bewildered by all of this. The city has pulled its float from the Pride parade there. Mayor says he's not going to march in the parade. By the way, billionaire Ken Griffin has dropped another $5 million into Ervin's campaign, so the total spend there is now $50 million. And it's not just in Aurora. New York and San Francisco parades have similarly disinvited the police. I'm not naive to the abuses of the police, but this isn't just tearing down bridges. This is keeping bridges from being built. Why do you not include the cops? Am I missing something here?
I completely agree with you, John. And I think, of course, there are historical injustices committed on the LGBT community by police. That's no one disagrees with that. But I think to not allow uniformed police officers in something like this is really infantilizing a large portion of the LGBT community, including those who are police officers,
yeah,
and totally deserve the ability to march beside people in a cause that they believe in as well. And I think this idea that you're pitting an identity group against the police to the point where they can't even be in the same march, but yet are still going to be there protecting it,
yeah,
which I think is the most absurd part of this.
That's ironic.
It is a total slap in the face. And it really, as you said, I think burns bridges unnecessarily.
Heather, my understanding is that in the Chicago Pride Parade, the police could, but they won't let them because it's a staffing issue. But they're not banned from it, correct?
Correct. And there aren't enough staff to not be on duty, which I think is probably a pretty clear encapsulation of the staffing crunch facing the Chicago police right now. It's an interesting question because, of course, before Pride was a parade, Pride was a protest and a demand for equal rights. And I think that in recent years, we've seen Pride parades becoming very commercial and very sort of middle of the road. And there's certainly been a movement from some gay rights activists to sort of reclaim that protest sort of at the heart of Pride parades. And I think that does bring it in conflict, at least on some level, with police departments, because of course Pride recognizes the Stonewall riots in New York, which was triggered by a police action in a gay and lesbian bar. So there's certainly tension here. And I don't know that there's a clear cut answer, sort of who's right, who's wrong on this, especially at this moment where gay rights are certainly under attack throughout the country, you know, not necessarily in Chicago or Illinois, but certainly in other states.
But not necessarily under attack by police. I mean, that's to me the sort of odd thing, too. I understand where the pendulum is swinging in some circles, but I don't think it's the police that are swinging it.
Yeah, I don't know that you can sort of separate the police from sort of as representatives of the state who are passing these laws. And I
really
think that
I mean, yeah. Really?
No, I mean, if you have the city seal on your uniform and you have the ability to take away somebody's liberty acting on behalf of that state, you are a representative of that government.
Fair enough. But don't you also agree then that some police officers, through no fault of their own, are now the victim of the uniform they're wearing? They didn't pass these policies. They might themselves be gay.
Sure. And that's always a conflict. That's always a tension of being a police officer, right? Because I've spoken to, you know, Black police officers who are very conflicted about that, those sort of competing identities. That is certainly an issue. And the question is, does it make sense for a uniformed officer to participate in essentially a remembrance of a revolt against police power?
But Brandon, then I would kick the Republicans of DuPage County out before I kick out the police.
I'm sort of in agreement with Austin and John to a degree. It does feel like picking a fight. However, there are communities who do feel they don't feel warm and fuzzy when they see police officers marching in a parade. You know, the idea of, you know, armed people smiling and waving doesn't quite make everyone feel safe or give them warm feelings.
Does BLM have a parade, and do the officers march in that? That's not a rhetorical question. I don't know the answer to it.
It like you said, it feels like it's a move that would divide people. However, if I'm an officer who wants to be there and wants to, you know, show my solidarity with the LGBTQ plus community, and they're asking that I'm not in uniform, I don't have my weapon, then hey, grab your t-shirt. I believe you can still wear a police insignia on the shirt, right?
Yeah.
And still have your pride for being a police officer, but also just respect the wishes of that community. But I can say that if this were the Bud Billiken parade, if this were a Juneteenth parade, I could understand why Black residents would feel like, maybe don't have guns on you. Maybe don't have the uniforms.
I think the symbolism of a uniformed officer marching in a parade, showing his or her allyship with the cause or even membership in that community, is powerful. And I'm reminded during some of the George Floyd protests, there were some images of police officers taking a knee with protesters. And that was a symbol that not all these police officers consider you to be their enemy, ideologically or personally, and that you know, we're all in this together. You know that there are going to be uniformed armed police officers on the streets of Aurora, and for them to march in this parade in solidarity, I think sends a really good message. Plus the fact that social politics, like regular politics, is about addition, not subtraction. And this seems like an alienating act. And it pushes the police officers away. It might create some hostility where none would exist. And I just think it's a missed opportunity on the part of Aurora Pride and San Francisco Pride, New York Pride, to say, look, police are not only are police, can police be our allies, but they are also, in some cases, members of our community, and we have some common cause with some of them anyway, maybe many of them. So I think it just seems needlessly polarizing.
I do think there is something to be said about this idea of unity, right? And whose responsibility is it to come to the table and really provide that forward action of unity? I get that it seems divisive, but I'm not sure that it's on the LGBTQ plus community to be the unifier here, in a sense, right? If the cops want to kind of build those bridges, then wear your ordinary clothes or your police officer t-shirt or whatever clothing you wear to the basketball tournament and just show up and be in solidarity and accept that there might be some things there that might make them uncomfortable if you were in uniform. In that sense, I look at it like, is it a big deal for these cops not to be in uniform? You know, if you really care, just come.
On the other hand, I think that the symbolism is broader than just what is delivered to the community. That when people who are watching the parade, people who are not part of the community, who are just residents of Aurora, and they see their police officers, their uniformed police officers marching in this parade, they are sending a message to the citizens of Aurora that the gay and the LGBTQ community is part of our community.
Yeah.
And we protect them and we respect them and we march in their parade. And those of you who have other opinions, I think that the symbolism is excellent. And maybe Brandon's right. But if they had this conversation, they could have had it in a closed meeting where they say, hey, look, you know, it might be cooler if you guys showed up in your police t-shirts and, you know, and instead of your uniforms, and the cops might have said, oh yeah, okay, well maybe that is better all around, but as it is, it's now this big news story that I think is it's polarizing.
And it would seem to me like if it was at a Juneteenth or Bud Billiken parade and you saw the officers in uniform marching with their service weapons on their hips, then wouldn't that say we're not fighting you, we're protecting you? That may ring a little hollow, but I mean, that is the image. That's what we're trying to convey here. I wonder what the... Now I'm cutting you off again, Brandon. What are you thinking?
It's okay.
you inhaled like you had something profound to say. I've seen you inhale before.
Oh, it's never anything profound.
Well, I'm also wondering what Richard Irvin should do then. I mean, everything he says and does now is being scrutinized. Not that he seems to have many original thoughts, but so he said, fine, the city's now going to pull... This is the tat for the tit. So he's going to pull their float out of the parade, and he's not going to march in it.
I mean, if you're in a Republican primary, the hit that you would get for marching in a parade that refuses to allow police officers to march in uniform would be pretty substantial, especially in a Republican primary.
Especially the campaign he's running, too.
Right, exactly. But I think he probably did. I agree with his move as mayor, perhaps mostly because it's creating a false binary between LGBT people and the police. There are many gay police officers, and it's good, and we should have awareness and representation of that. And that's part of the whole message of the parade. Now, I totally agree with Heather that it becomes cringy at a point where it's like Citibank is the number one champion of gay rights and always has it right. Like it seems kind of disingenuous. Which I think that's another, a whole other conversation. But the fact you're just singling out this profession because of to make a political point that I think we would be irresponsible to assume is the opinion of even a majority of the people even marching in the event. It is definitely the opinion of whoever is putting on the event, but that might be a very small minority of the gay community in Aurora. I don't think it serves anyone well, and the Mayor Irvin was right to pull out.
Well, that is similar to a conversation we had last year. It must have been around Pride, because I remember John Hansen, one of our co-mincing rascals, sort of decrying the homogenization of Pride, where it's Citibank and Chevrolet, and they've all got floats, and it's not that the thing lost its identity, but you wondered about the sincerity of it. Are they just courting customers, or are they really behind the LGBTQ community? Though 9 were killed and 42 more shot and wounded over Memorial Day weekend. And those are the worst numbers we've seen in 5 years. Mayor Lori Lightfoot said, hooray. She said, we were able to safely return to a series of fantastic events that defined summertime in Chicago. It was the 3-day Memorial Day weekend. In fact, that is the very sort of weekend that she previously described as a bloodbath. I would argue that both can be true, guys, that it was a great, safe, summertime fun weekend for millions of people, and for hundreds it was deadly and tragic and terrible.
It's confusing because if in 2020 you're going to say a Memorial Day weekend with 49 people shot and 10 killed is a bloodbath and a fail that Superintendent David Brown needs to answer for, and then 2 years later you're going to have 47 people shot and 9 people killed, and you're going to declare that in some ways a success, I think that defies logic. Part of it, I think, has to do with the fact that we've become somewhat inured to this sort of record-breaking surge of crime and violence in Chicago, because while in May 2020, that was really something we hadn't seen for many years, it is not unusual, I have to say, nowadays. And the other thing is that, once again, this violence was concentrated on the South and the West Sides. You did not have a high-profile downtown or North Side incident that brought, and let me be perfectly clear here, white people into contact with gun and gang violence. And that in some ways makes it less obvious that the violence is still happening. And it gives the mayor essentially more cover to say, well, the people up north and downtown weren't disruptive, so they got to have their holiday weekend. And it's honestly less of a political problem. Now, I'm not saying that that's right. I'm not saying that that's how it should be. I'm just saying that that's how it works in Chicago this weekend.
The battle cry on this podcast last week was save the bean, save the bean. I mean, you know, let's at least take out a tourist spot that people will focus on, make that super safe. I think Austin created that chant last week, but you know, there is a little something to that, right, Heather?
There's no doubt that Lightfoot knows that she's vulnerable politically on the issue of public safety. So it is in her best interest to declare victory, right? Is that believable for the people of Chicago? And, you know, will the news coverage sort of cast what happened to weekend as a victory? I don't know the answer to that.
Why would the news coverage cast this weekend as a victory? I mean, what I would like to see from Lightfoot is not decrying a bloodbath or saying that the summer of joy has begun, but some anger and some determination to get this problem under control in both instances.
She hasn't done that? She hasn't shown anger and determination to try and get this fixed?
In reacting to these, to this holiday news, what I want to hear from her is more of a steady approach and a sense of determination and anger about this, and not trying to spin it. And it feels to me political. It feels like, you know, in 2020, it was her first full year in office. And so she was going to crack down on this, was when things were going to change. Now we're in the last year of her first term, and she's got to answer to voters in next February. And she wants, I think, the message to be that things are going well. And that's why you've got this Summer of Joy thing happening, and why she's saying all these nice things about Superintendent Brown, who, as Heather points out, she accused of having a massive fail 2 years ago for having almost exactly the same weekend. So I feel like there's just a political tone to her response that leaves me as a city resident not particularly satisfied.
This felt like a really weird time to be patting themselves on the back. I like what Heather said. She pretty much said what I was going to say when it comes to, you know, it's a success in her eyes because nothing happened in the jewel, as she calls it, the downtown. Or in more layman's terms, no white people got shot. So therefore, success. We survived Memorial Day weekend, everybody. Celebrate great work. I believe David Brown said he would give his officers A's across the board for everything that happened. To be fair, while we saw shootings and deaths up this Memorial Day, we did see gun arrests up as well by 69% compared to the weekend last year. So there was a good thing, but there was a positive thing to go there. But there was so much bloodshed that happened still that it just, you can't be having a, you know, a little parade and saying, okay, we've made progress. Look at us. Look at us. Like, a man was driving in his van and got shot as he was driving in one of these cases, shot and killed. But three guys got shot on their porch. Like, these are not normal things. That's a crisis. And it shouldn't be just like, oh, South and West Side, it's going to happen. Chuck up the deuces and just focus on the North. That's what mayors of the past have done. This mayor has run on being different. Nothing's different.
I'd also say that she hasn't taken questions since Memorial Day weekend. how is it a success if 47 people have been shot and 10 people have been killed? I've heard the mayor be angry and stern about violence and crime any number of different times. I don't know that that's a solution to what is happening.
Right. I'm not saying that being stern is a solution. I'm just saying that's the tone that I would like her to set and keep when it comes to this issue.
Okay, Eric, then maybe she shouldn't celebrate all of this, but I also don't think you guys should marginalize the value of a safe Gold Coast and Lakefront and Grant Park and Millennium Park during Memorial Day weekend. I mean, you guys almost sound as though you'd be happier if the crime were spread more equally all across the city. I'm not celebrating the fact that anybody got shot, but we would be sitting here decrying the fact if there was violence at the Bean again, and there wasn't. That's a good thing, right? Let's not criticize the city for making high-traffic tourist spots safe. That's what happened on Memorial Day weekend.
Traditionally, gun and gang violence is very rare downtown. And I think that you can certainly make an argument that what happened with the mass shooting at Chicago and State and the murder at the Bean was an anomaly that the city reacted to in a way because it posed a threat to sort of its tourism and finances and self-image. If violence in one part of town poses an immediate political problem for the mayor, that she's got to have multiple press conferences and put out new initiatives, and she does not have to do that when there's violence on the south and the west side, I think it behooves me as a journalist to say, well, why is that? And I think we know why that is. It's structural racism.
I think both of your points are valid, but it's more that there's no way to attribute a big change in policing or economic opportunity in the city of Chicago to, you know, a weekend where we happen to not have any violence downtown. In other words, what you would like to be hearing from the mayor is, here's the three long-term initiatives that I think are important that will reduce violence everywhere. I'm going to do the police consent decree that we're way, way, way behind on. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make sure our schools aren't failing our children as they currently are. And I'm going to crack down on gang violence in this way, which is driving so much of this. And if you can point to changes you've made in those three areas and the effects that it has had on violence, that would be that I think is the ideal for how you're supposed to be communicating with residents. We're tackling these big problems in these ways, and that is directly leading to a reduction in crime. Whereas what I think the point maybe Heather is making and others is that, yeah, having one safe weekend downtown, that just you can do that by throwing all the bodies there. You know, you could just do that by taking all the police and putting them on Michigan Avenue. And yeah, maybe that is great if that results in less crime, but we are left with these longstanding problems and that are really, really bad.
Trying to get my head around the structural racism that you referenced to. Tourists don't tend to shoot tourists, but if on the south and west side gangs are shooting each other, that is a neighborhood problem that those communities have. And I'm trying to understand where the structural racism is by the city or the police if they decided to take these jewels of our great city and protect the image, protect the economics, and protect the people of them. If you can't save everybody from everybody, I don't understand the problem with making sure that high trafficked areas are safe.
Oh, no. When I was referring to structural racism, I was referring to the fact that we tolerate high levels of violence on the south and the west sides that we would not tolerate as a city on the north and downtown side. That's the structural racism. It doesn't have anything to do with sort of this specific sort of debate. But the fact is that when there is violence downtown and on the north side, mm-hmm. and it impacts white people, proclamations get made, initiatives are announced, there's hubbub, it's a crisis.
Well, I wonder if Paul Vallis is going to be able to fix that. I wonder if somebody else, I mean, we all see the problem. I don't know that any of us has the solution. Evidently, Mayor Lori Lightfoot doesn't. But I wonder if it's reasonable to judge her sincerity or her efficacy if, in fact, nobody else has a better idea. I mean, you don't have a million police officers, and this thing is inherent in some communities that the city cannot solve. I think the solution has to come somewhat from within. listen, I'm not a great defender of Lori Lightfoot here, but I'm just trying to be realistic about the criticism.
It's a tough job, and cities across the country are facing the same exact issue. New York just had a subway shooting, and I'm just like, oh my God, 10 people shot inside a New York subway. LA's police chief, I'll never forget, I was down there in LA a few months ago, and the Uber driver laughed at me and said, you're brave for being here. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, oh, our police chief went on TV yesterday and said, if you come to LA, we can't guarantee we can protect you. And I'm just like, wow. So this is a crisis happening, not just here in Chicago, but around the country, and mayors across the country are dealing with it or trying to find ways to deal with it and to stop the bleeding. And I think it's going to take more than any quick fix to get this handled. There's not really a one size fits all. But if we attack, like Heather was talking about the structural racism, if we attack the things at the structure that lead to these things and hit things at the root, we're not going to see things change overnight, but I think we would see a gradual decline in the violent incidents we're seeing across the country if we attack those systemic issues that often give way to the violence we see on the south and west sides of these cities.
And Paul Vallis does have plans to throw a lot of money at some of those structural issues, right? He finished in last place, though, in the last mayoral election, didn't he?
No, he finished ninth out of 14.
Ninth place.
You might as well be last.
he got 5.4% of the vote. Did not perform all that well. Didn't have a lot of money. And I thought he was going to do better than he did. I didn't think he was necessarily going to make the runoff. But that was a low number, and it surprised me. And I don't know that the time is right for him now, but he does seem to be more a man of the moment than he was 4 years ago.
Yeah.
It's hard to know. I wanted to ask Heather before she has to sign off if she's got any other ideas about who might be jumping into this race. There's certainly a long list of names of people who are talked about. And there's only five names in there right now.
Really, everybody in Chicago is thinking about running for mayor. Your neighbor, the guy at the corner store. The perception is, rightly or wrongly, is that Lightfoot is very vulnerable. But we really have months and months and months of months before this field is going to be set. I keep amazing people when I remind them that Rahm Emanuel did not drop out of the race until after Labor Day, and it is just barely Memorial Day. So there is a lot of time, and this is an especially weird election year because we haven't even had the Democratic and the Republican primaries yet for the statewide office. So people are going to either win or lose those races, and they will make decisions about what to do next after those results are in. So it's still really very early. But, you know, it is interesting that two of the four candidates, major candidates who've declared, are people who ran in 2019, lost in the first round, and then endorsed Lori Lightfoot and then came to regret it almost immediately. And that's Willie Wilson and Paul Vallis. Both candidates now have to sort of explain to the voters, so I lost to this woman and then I endorsed her and then she did what I think is a terrible job. But trust me this time, it's not your normal campaign sort of opening.
That's a bad bumper sticker, isn't it? Yeah.
Pat Quinn is being talked about. I know we always forget Frederick Collins, the Chicago police officer. So there are actually six declared candidates already.
There are a lot of minor candidates. I will remind everybody that you're not a candidate until you pull papers and you submit nominating positions and you get on the ballot.
Is it possible that Anna Valencia or Alexi Junilius, the one who loses the Secretary of State's primary, but jump in for the mayor's race?
Absolutely. Anything's possible.
And of course, there are also the candidates running for Bobby Rush's seat in Congress. And most of them are going to lose. Obviously, only one's going to win. And there are a bunch of them who are like Alderman Pat Dowell, Jonathan Jackson, Karen Dorrington Reeves, Jonathan Swain, Jamal Cole, maybe any or all of them could jump into that race, too. So
absolutely. Not to mention Gil Villegas and Delia Ramirez on the northwest side. They're running for Congress. We all just need to like meditate, do like a calm app on our phone, and we will get to the 2023 municipal elections in due time.
You know, it's interesting, Heather, you brought up these people that have endorsed Lightfoot and then now they have to be in that awkward position of running against her. And then I think about who would be a very interesting candidate this cycle would be Toni Preckwinkle, a woman who could literally just run a I told you so campaign. and just kind of run the same campaign as last time and maybe see a different result.
She has ruled it out.
She has said
that the 2019 election was sort of the most brutal, bruising experience of her life, and she is not going to do it. But you're not wrong, because she has run the county almost without drama since the mayoral election, and she's running for re-election in June.
Illinois, Cook County, and Chicago all take hits locally and nationally. I wonder which is the most difficult job, or the job that is hardest to sleep at night. There goes Heather. Thank you, Heather. Heather's just clicking out. She's got evidently a paying job. So I wonder which is the harder job to do. Or the least rewarding. Austin, do you want to be mayor of Chicago if I gave you $1 million?
I think mayor is the toughest. At least in the governor's office, you have a general assembly that, at least in name, is competent and doing policymaking, whereas the city council is not like that. And really, the mayor of Chicago just has so much unilateral power over so much that the city does that. I remember I was saying this when we were doing our press tour for the new Chicago Way. You could elect Pericles or Mother Teresa and you would get really bad outcomes because that office is just too powerful. And I do think Vallis is, I would describe him as the man who knows too much. He can talk anyone in Chicago under the table on any policy issue. He's extremely bright. And he knows where all the bodies are buried in the city budget and city operations. He has great detailed plans on how to fix things. And I think his challenge will be communicating that to voters in a way that shows, this, I'm not just a policy wonk. I'm someone, he has a really mm-hmm. interesting story. He's from Chicago, was born in Roseland. And he's got serious executive chops. He was head of CPS. He was head of Philadelphia Public Schools. He was head of New Orleans Public Schools, I believe, also. And really gets the structural issues. But I think his challenge will be communicating that. To Eric's point, I do think this is a moment where maybe voters are craving more of that executive experience in this role, given how the current administration is doing.
I want to take you guys just back one last time to the crime issue in Chicago. I had this conversation with some colleagues at the radio station. So I had 42 shot, 9 killed. I think Heather said 47 more shot, 9 killed. Those are the ballpark numbers for Memorial Day weekend. 2 weekends ago, the restaurant show was in Chicago, or 2 weeks ago, and there's 45,000 people came to the city, McCormick Place, and in the hotels, and had a swell time. And then I started to think, how many people were at Grant Park, Millennium Park, Navy Pier? How many people were downtown in the restaurants? How many people went to the theater district? When we total up the numbers, would it be appropriate reporting to total up the numbers of people who use the city the way Lori Lightfoot described Memorial Day weekend? Safely, and they had a nice time. Our radio station starts every newscast on Monday with the death toll. And I think that happened. That's news. But if you had, I started to do back of the envelope stuff, and I quickly came to 600,000 people I could account for who used the city safely. And all we're talking about is 9. And I'm thinking, okay, where's the balance here? And we never do that. And it would appear as boosterism, which is not news, were we to report that. But I think there should be some sort of metric or number that, if you're going to tell the story of Chicago on any given weekend, should also be reported. Does this seem like there's a hole in the journalists reporting about life in Chicago?
I don't have anything too deep to say on that. I was having a great conversation with Dorothy Tucker, who is the president of the National Association of Black Journalists. And she was telling me about how when she, she's been a reporter at CBS2 for decades, and how in the 90s, all the stations kind of had to come to an agreement and come together and change the way they covered crime and covered gang shootings and covered these things, because it was getting to a point where they were doing these crimes with the intention of it's going to be on television news. Just reporting numbers, like you said, from the outside world looking in, they're going to think Chicago's a war zone.
I do think there's a sort of an odd, I don't know what it is, maybe it's psychological. giving context to victims of gun violence in Chicago and creating more of, like, I don't know, like an effective rate of violence or something like that. Like it's like a weighted value or something, because the truly sad thing is most of the violence is relegated to a handful of extremely impoverished communities in Chicago. And a very uncomfortable truth is a large share of victims, I'm not saying all, a large share have been shooters or the victims of shootings previously and have been in prison previously. And that's uncomfortable to discuss because it's like, well, you see the horrible, you know, a 9-year-old girl. And I'm not saying like what, you know, that family deserved that or anyone deserved a tragedy like that. But when you hear a number like 40 people were killed over the weekend, that's a tragedy. But most people in Chicago, most Black, most white, most Latino people in Chicago were not in positions over the weekend where they would have been a victim of something like that. And that's a very nuanced discussion that is very difficult to get into.
Austin, I have tried to make that point on the radio, and maybe not so eloquently as you just did, but that's what I'm driving at here, that the city, as Laurie said, can be safely enjoyed over the summertime or any time of the year. I mean, we all come downtown. We all live in the city. And when my listeners will call or text in and say, I'm not going there. It's the Wild West. It's too dangerous. I'm thinking, this place is packed with people. The boats just went by me for the river tour are full of folks, and none of them are getting shot. And by the way, they will all be able to avoid getting shot because they don't shoot people themselves, and they're not on the south and west side. This city can be safely enjoyed. And I don't know if it's a ratio of convention business and take the theater and the concerts and add them up and then divide by the number of people that were shot. It's gruesome math, but I mean, come up with some number, and at least then you would be able to track how, I don't know, safe or something the city is, because we're not doing that. There's no presentation of how safe and enjoyable the city is. It's only the violence. I think it's lazy reporting is what it is.
And, you know, John, part of the reason for that, too, is if you look across the industry, not just in Chicago, but around the country, newsrooms are slashing budgets and they're slashing their arts, their culture coverage, those things that would highlight those things, right?
Yeah.
And it leads to a heavy, heavy focus on crime, negativity, bad, bad, and not so much what else there is going on in our city. And so I'd love to see more support for the arts and more support for that community as well, because we have, like you said, there's so much happening here in Chicago that's positive. People enjoy living here. I love living in Chicago.
That's what John Hansen's whole podcast is about, right?
He's exactly. Like, it's all good.
He finds good things happening in Chicago and highlights them. Whereas, and then he comes on this podcast and we talk about how horrible.
Well, but Eric, as a longtime journalist at the Chicago Tribune, how do you feel the newsroom or the newspaper would feel generally about a sentence or a paragraph or a story or every Monday feature like I'm describing? And I'm not saying to say it wasn't all bad, but in fact, it wasn't all bad. Tell us the number. Find some way to tell us what city life was really like on any given weekend.
I think that the papers do try to do that. That the news stations do try to do that. The problem is, as Brandon points out, is that the newsrooms are stretched thin and that you do have a responsibility to report the mayhem. I mean, that is a story. And if you don't report it, you're going to get lots of, you know, the Tribune's covering it up. The Sun-Times is covering
it up. I know. That's what it'll look like.
And so you need to balance that. And if you don't have the staffing to do that, then it ends up looking like you're just sensationalizing crime. But I feel that the papers do that. And those stories, I don't think, get the kind of clicks.
How do they do that, Eric?
Child
how do they do
shot.
That? I don't think they do that at all. Contextualize the bad versus the good.
Well, the contextualization would happen within the layout of the paper. You're not going to have someone say, well, there was this wonderful parade on the south side and all these kids came out. And even though people were being shot else, you know, you don't do that in a story. You just tell the good story. You tell something good that's happening, and then the other coverage, the other parts of the paper balance it out. But I think it's important. I mean, the other thing is sometimes you'll see maps of where some of these crimes are happening, And they do tend to be concentrated in some of the more disadvantaged neighborhoods. Although they are, you know, some of the carjacking maps, the armed robbery maps, yeah, are showing up in Lincoln Park. They're showing up certainly in Wicker Park, Logan Square, places like that. So,
in the Chicago suburb of Western Springs, Alliance Township High School English teacher resigned. As of today, his post set off a storm, at least on my radio show for 2 days. His complaints why he's quitting include students don't do homework. Teachers can't give them a lower grade for that. Homework is not graded, so kids just don't do it. There are no hard due dates for major assignments. Kids can turn them in whenever. And if they do turn them in, they can then revise them to get a better grade if they don't like the grade they got. A Stevenson High School teacher who just quit his job as a sociology teacher said last year he called into our show. He was getting final assignments in August, just before the start of the next school year for these kids. Some of them were finally turning them in. And this doesn't even go down the road of discipline and the phones, the sort of distractions kids have in the classroom or to try and learn at home and do homework is just a completely different conversation than we're used to having. And then we heard from some other people who say, you have no idea how much times have changed. And if you used to go to your bedroom and do your homework and then turn it in and you got a grade, that's not the world we live in right now. That's not even a practical, that's not a almost even feasible way to imagine education these days. Is completely changed. You didn't have the distractions of social media. And some of these kids go home to families where education isn't prized, and even if it is, they don't have a quiet room to study.
Well, I certainly have sympathy for anybody who can't find a quiet place to study and get his or her homework done. I don't have a lot of sympathy for a student who says, I can't do my history reading because I have to be on Instagram. I have to be on TikTok, and this is distracting me, and therefore I don't have to turn in my assignments on time. I mean, I feel like I'm kind of old school on this, which is that education is designed to prepare you for the real world. And in the real world, you got to get your assignments done on time. You got to show up. I mean, the thing that these stories are talking about is that the teachers aren't even allowed to factor attendance or lack of attendance into the grade.
Yeah.
In the real world, you got to show up. You got to show up to your job. Your supervisor tells you she wants a project done by Friday. You got to get it done by Friday, or you're going to lose that job. You're not going to get that raise. I mean, it doesn't seem to me like you're doing these kids any favors by coddling them like this, by saying, oh, it doesn't matter when you turn in your assignments, and oh, we'll give you another chance. That's not preparing them for the real world, and that's what school should be doing. Okay, now I'll get off my high horse.
So it's interesting. I just wrapped up my first semester as a professor at Columbia College, my first semester grading students.
Do you have to call you doctor now?
You could. No, professor. I don't think that'd be appropriate.
Professor Pope.
Professor Pope works. I don't got the doctorate yet. Waiting on my honorary. But the way I approached grading was that at the base of it was your attendance. You have to show up and be present. Your attendance and participation. That's the bare minimum. If you don't have those, you fail the class. Simple as that. I ran a class where I didn't give that many assignments. So you really had to make sure you were present. And if there was an issue with an assignment and you not being able to get it in on time, if you gave me prior heads up, we could talk about it, discuss it, what those reasons were, and I'd make a decision from there. But if you're just not doing the assignment, it's a zero. Well, I read, this teacher, what he has to go through here, and I'm in complete agreement with them. I understand why he left. There are certain things you need to have. You need to have structure. Students have to have consequences or they're going to blow the class off. They're not going to learn anything at all. And what, like you said, Eric, what is that going to teach them in the long run? No one likes homework, right? But you do have to have parameters for learning.
Well, get a load of this. A guy called them who described himself as an administrative coach. He teaches schools and teachers how to teach. And he said that, for instance, these formative assignments, the homework assignments that the kids get, that's part of the learning process. So if we all studied algebra for a class period, and then you came home at night and you didn't exactly get it, you're working on it, and you do terrible on your homework assignment, you turn it in and you get 3 out of 10 right, well, that's a failing grade on that homework assignment. And in fact, why are we punishing a kid who's trying to learn, but they don't have it yet? So it's deemed a formative thing, and the kid should not be penalized for doing poorly on the homework. Now, how do you know if the kid just blew it off or if they really worked on it and they haven't got it yet? But the upshot is we're not going to grade homework. That's part of the learning process. Good golly damn, that is so different from my experience as a kid. I mean, I would call friends or find somebody and go, how do you do this problem? What are we going to do? You know, you'd stress about it. And they said, that's another thing. The emotional freight, the mental freight that kids carry these days is a lot. So you can fold your arms and be old school about it, but they're not going to do it. They're not getting it.
It's kind of a question of what we want a normal public school to do and what function we want it to play. So if you wanted schools to just make sure you're graduating as many competent people as possible, the way to measure competence perhaps wouldn't be homework. It would just be tests, right? That's what it seems like this policy change is going toward. All the grade is based on how you do on the test. The test is going to grade your competency in this subject. The problem is, homework is not only meant to increase your competency, it's so that teachers can review it and see how far along you are and make you better. And that they have, so it's not by the time you flunk a test, you already would have had signs, you know, way back that this kid is not going to do well on the test. The problem I see is, hey, great, maybe schools should experiment with getting rid of homework. But what I don't think will happen is that anyone is held accountable to a standard of competency after that. You're still going to be ratcheting kids up grade after grade. Illinois has what's called social promotion. So there's every effort made not to hold kids back, whereas a state like Florida banned social promotion. And to get out of third grade, you really do have to demonstrate competency in math and reading, because that's a critical year. What I worry about in Illinois is that you get rid of these standards and then it just devolves into even worse outcomes for students. And there was a fantastic report that WirePoints put out yesterday. It's called Poor Student Achievement and Zero Accountability. And it is, there are truly shocking numbers in there about educational outcomes in Illinois. And if you look at a city like Decatur, for example, all students in Decatur in third grade, only 9% can read at grade level in Decatur. Among Black students, it is 2%. Among white students, it is 16%. So this is just an incredible failure of a community in central Illinois that has increasingly gotten more money every year from the state, high per student spending, but there's just zero accountability for results. And what I fear is that in the face of these terrible results, a lot of the administrators in Illinois and sort of the education bureaucracy is going to move toward, well, the standard must be broken. If it's this bad, then we got to change the standard. And I think that is a very, very slippery slope. And I think sort of what this teacher's open letter kind of gets at.
There's a mom who sent me a note today, her daughter senior year at New Trier. I mean, one of the marquee schools in the country. She said that was an AB student who going into her senior year realized, I'll just take an I for incomplete. And I pass and it didn't hurt my GPA and I don't care about my GPA. And all of this is on the heels of the pandemic for the last couple of years. But a lot of this, I understand, sort of predated the pandemic, this sort of change in grading standards, what we expect from the kids in terms of participation. Somebody reminded me that in some of these classes, you don't even have to attend regularly. And the one teacher said he sees 3-4 students sometimes, which I can't get my head around. I don't understand that. That can't be true. I mean, are the kids zooming in, which is a complete fail? Are they just not showing up? I don't understand it. But listen, the fact that I don't understand it or I don't like it doesn't mean that that's not the reality. So while I'm critical of this, I'm also just kind of coming to grips with this. One last thing. The guy who called in, who was the administrative coach, he said when he does go into schools and talks to teachers about how they're going to have to change their ways, boy, imagine that sell. He said, I started out with, name something that hasn't changed in 100 years. Educational grading hasn't changed in 100 years. We say it's 100 points, you get an A, B, C, or D, or an F. And that's kind of it. And the times have changed so much. Y'all got to figure something else out. And then they've got these other systems and schemes.
But just because something has gone for 100 years doesn't necessarily mean that it's invalid, though, right?
Yeah, I didn't say that to him. That's a good point. But I do understand the idea that, like Eric, I think you should have sympathy for a kid whose TikTok or Instagram account is distracting them, because it's distracting them. So what are you going to do about it, Eric? Just sit there and say, you shouldn't be distracted? That doesn't fix it.
Well, but saying, well, go ahead and go on Instagram and go on TikTok and don't worry about your homework because it doesn't matter. And as Austin points out, homework, it is to keep students on track. I agree that if a student does poorly on homework, especially at the beginning, that's a warning sign for the teacher. That's a way for a teacher to keep track of what a student's doing. If the student says, well, I don't have to do this because it doesn't matter, then the student can really, really fall behind right away. And it does matter. And that, you know, it's like tests and homework and quizzes and all these things are meant to keep students, not just keep them motivated, but to keep an eye on where they're going so that you can have these course adjustments. Yeah. And do I feel sorry for kids who get home and they feel like they have to have all their notifications turned on? I guess I don't. I mean, I guess I feel like somebody in their life needs to underscore to them, and it ought to be, if it can't be a parent, it's got to be a teacher, that you need to log off these things because you've got to get this stuff done because it's important. Because if you don't get it done, then you're not going to be able to achieve some of the long-term goals that you have for yourself. I don't know. I mean, I say, like, I'm a bit of a hard ass on this, and you know, I'd like to be understanding, but at some point, you know, you're not physically addicted to Instagram.
Yeah, you are physically addicted to Instagram.
It's tough because I see both sides here. At some point, you do have to turn it off, right? There's got to be a switch. All of us here use social media, but we also have a switch. Me and Austin, maybe more so than Eric and John. But we both understand, hey, when it's time to go on, that goes off. So I think that needs to be taught. But I do think a great teacher can utilize these tools like TikTok and Instagram and bring that into the curriculum and update that a little bit and help kids out in that sense.
Do your kids have the phones in the classroom, and do they have them on when you're teaching?
No, but there are assignments that incorporate social media.
I'm amazed that we've had this conversation before, that the kids have their phones on in the classroom in high school. Mm-hmm. I think that's insane. I think that's crazy. And Lord knows that those phones were very potentially helpful to the kids who were in that classroom in Texas. They were the ones calling 911.
Well, that's the thing, John, because these parents are the ones fighting for that. They're the ones that want their students to have those cell phones on them. You're going to get more of a fight from the parents, I feel like, than you would students themselves.
Maybe, that's what I hear.
Maybe equally. Yeah.
Well, Robb Elementary is still an outlier. I mean, it's still an outlier. When you just say, if we're trying to educate the children of 330 million Americans, what's the best course of action? I say kids do not have phones in the classroom.
When my 25-year-olds were in high school, the rule, they're Chicago Public High School, and the rule was that you could have your phone with you, but it had to be not turned off, but not making any noise and not visible to the teacher. So essentially in your knapsack, right? And so it's there. And between classes, you can check it for emergencies or messages. But during class, if your phone is out, the teacher would confiscate it. Just hold it at the desk until after class is over.
And they should have a wood chipper. They should drop the phone in a wood chipper.
Now, there's an old school guy right there.
I don't want to say I'm old.
A wood chipper. Not these new iPhones, man. You get a lot of complaints.
Yeah, you need a hickory switch.
All right. We're out of time, guys. Any last words of wisdom from anybody? Anybody want to recommend anything? I mentioned the documentary on HBO was pretty good about George Carlin. I was thoroughly entertained by that thing. Anything else anybody's been reading or looking at they want to pass along?
Let me tell you, if you're a Star Wars fan, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Episode 3 is one of the greatest pieces of Star Wars content I have ever seen in my life. I almost wanted to cry this morning. I woke up early, 6 o'clock in the morning, just to watch that. And it was so rewarding. So if you're a Star Wars fan, don't blow it off. Obi-Wan Kenobi is the show you've been wanting.
Professor, we did not know that you were such a giant nerd.
Oh, big time.
Really?
Big time.
So what is that? A show that is streaming? Is that what you're looking at?
It's streaming on Disney Plus with new episodes every Wednesday.
Wow.
I heard the new Norm Macdonald special is really good. I'm going to watch it tonight. I premiered my first short doc last week in Telluride, Colorado.
Congrats.
It's not out yet, but it's called, if you go to freetocarefilm.com, you can go learn about it. We premiered it in Colorado. It's a story of a mom from Illinois, from Decatur, actually, which was mentioned now the second time it's been mentioned in this podcast. Her name is Lisa Creason. She committed a crime when she was 19 years old, served 6 years in prison, got out, turned her life around, raised three kids by herself, wanted to get her kids out of a bad neighborhood in Decatur, buy a house. So she tried to pursue a career as a registered nurse, went to school for 7 years to get her nursing degree, passed all of her tests with flying colors, then got a call from the state of Illinois saying, you are not, because of a law passed last year, your license is suspended indefinitely and you will never be able to become a registered nurse. And that was when I came back to Illinois, one of the first stories that I worked on. We helped change that law in Illinois. And there are 15 other states where men and women like her would still not be able to pursue careers in the healthcare field. So we're taking this little short documentary around and trying to change the law in those states. So
wow.
Is it available for streaming anywhere? Or?
Not yet. But if you go to freetocarefilm.com, you can sign up and we'll...
And that's a T-O in the middle, not the number two, right?
T-O, yep.
Freetocare.com.
Congrats, wow. Austin.
Wow, Austin. You buried the lead, man. I would have told everybody about that. I'm glad you brought that up.
Best part, I got this hat. I got this hat from Mountain Film. That's the one I'm wearing. So,
oh, wow.
A movie maker
hat.
I got a hat.
Yeah. Say cut in action. I want to see you.
I got the gesture down.
I want to promote the new season of Slow Burn on Slate. Slate has a series of podcasts called Slow Burn, doing historical work, and they've just launched their next season, which is about Roe v. Wade. It's about abortion in America before Roe v. Wade, and on the editorial team is Johanna Zorn.
Holy cow!
Congratulations! Wow,
yeah.
Cool. You buried that lead, for crying out loud.
Buried that lead, yeah.
All these important, impressive people. Wow. All right. Well, I just do a radio show at WGN Radio. Thank you, Austin. Thank you, Brandon. Thank you, Eric. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. Thank you also to Heather Sharon, who had to exit stage left. And we will drop another podcast on you next week.
Thanks. Hey, that was a fun party last week.
Yeah, how'd that go? I was bummed.
Brandon and I were there getting free drinks.
That was great. It was great. The beer nice. Was flowing.
If any of you guys want, I just had two people drop. I'm at an event tonight at the Four Seasons. If you want a free dinner, I have two seats at the table left. So if any of you guys want to come.
The Four Seasons. You know what, Austin? What time is it?
Talk to you, boys.
Well, see you later.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.